thanks for asking me here. I'm honored and humbled. What I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm not going to venture into any drunkologues. I believe that I have the credentials to be in this room, and I don't need to prove to you that I do. Secondly, if you hear anything that sounds like wisdom, take it for what it's worth, but it didn't come from me. It came from someone else. I've never had an original thought in my life. Okay, let me tell you about myself. I was born a long time ago into a military family. I was the only child of an Army sergeant and his wife. And I spent the first 18 of the first 18 years of my life, I spent probably 13 overseas. Now, back in those days, we're talking the 50s and the 60s, soldiers didn't make a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of stuff. We had enough. My mom ran a good home. My dad provided. Of course, being military, he was gone quite a bit, but, you know, for short periods. But home life was good. Home life was really good. My family, on both sides, used alcohol. My mom and dad would have a drink every night, one drink. They would have a Manhattan together before dinner, run me out of the room, talk about what moms and dads have to talk about, probably arranging a date for later in the evening. I didn't have a bunch of issues with alcohol in my home. Now, I had the occasional drunken uncle that would pop up every now and then, but it wasn't an effect on me. I took my first drink probably at the age of 12 or 13, and I didn't know why for the longest time, and I didn't think it mattered why I took my first drink. Until I came to a speaker meeting and I heard a woman talk about why she took her first drink, why she became a drinker. Not yet an alcoholic, but a drinker. And it resonated with me. It was the same thing. Said we didn't have a whole lot of money, but a lot of the kids around me had a lot of money, or some money, or more money than me. They wore better clothes, they went on better vacations, their dads drove a better car, they lived in better houses. And I think that I wanted what they had. But after hearing this woman speak at this meeting, I realized that what I really wanted was to be like the cool people. The cool people are the ones that I saw on television. If you're old enough to remember the Dean Martin show, he had a martini glass in his hand all the time. Mm-hmm. James Bond was very popular in the 60s. That guy always had a drink. I had the fortune of seeing Janis Joplin in concert. And she had a bottle of Southern Comfort on a stool next to her. And I thought, that's cool. And I looked around at the kids that I was going to school with, and I didn't really think the jocks were cool. And I really didn't think being academically successful was cool. The girls were cool. But I looked at what all the other older kids were doing, and a lot of them were drinking. And I said, if I want to be like that kid who's the quarterback on the football team, he drank, I probably ought to drink too, because that'll help make me cool.
cool.
It was about that time that I started to find out that alcohol could do some things for me. It could make me a glib speaker. It could make me clever. It could take away my shyness in situations. Make me a better dancer. Give me the courage to chat up a girl. Give me the courage to face down some jerk, because he figured this little 130-pound guy isn't going to, he must have something up his sleeve. I'm not going to mess with him anymore. I talked myself out of a lot of fights. Of course, my drinking got me into those fights, but I talked myself out of them. So that was pretty much it. And when I look back at it, and I look at at what I see around today, I don't think that's a whole lot different than the course a lot of kids take today. Sad to say. So let's roll the clock forward a couple of years. We ended up coming back from overseas. I had been academically unsuccessful. I didn't even have the grades to do anything. So my dad came back to Newport News, Virginia. And I got home on a Friday, and I kind of hung around. And I was 18, so I could drink his Busch beer. And on Monday morning, my mom packed me a lunch and gave me 10 cents and drove me downtown Newport News, telling me, "Your dad says you can use that dime to ride the bus home or call me for a ride when you have a job. And he recommends that you go into the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company and tell him that your long-haired ass would like a job." Yeah. Well, they put me in a department that I had absolutely no business in. I weighed all of 130 pounds soaking wet. And on the job, every time somebody had picked something up heavy, they'd expect me to have the other end. And this isn't going to work out for me. But I hung out there for a year or so. And I have good memories. I had some good experiences in there. Roll forward a couple of months. The Army had a spot for me. And I said, let me give these guys a try. The Army's been pretty good for my dad. I had absolutely no idea of what I wanted to do in life. I had a lot of dreams, you know, those dreams that 18 and 19 year olds have. I had a bunch of them. No way of how to enact them. But I was going to go in the Army. And by the way, the Army is not cool. Or at least it wasn't for a private. So I showed on up, and things were good. They gave me 3 hot meals a day. They gave me clothes, gave me a roof over my head. I shared that room with 40 other guys, but that was okay. And then I was just on the cusp of what they called the Volunteer Army. They put beer machines in the barracks. How friggin' stupid was that? 10 cents a can. Well, I was making $98 a month. You can buy a lot of 10-cent beer for Schlitz, but I did that. Well, everything in the Army in those days seemed to revolve, get every event seemed to terminate with beer. On payday, the first sergeant take everybody out and buy them beer. Picnics that the unit had involved beer. You'd go out with your buddies on the town, involved beer. They started to allow us to keep liquor in the barracks. So when I could afford it, I would get a bottle of, I think they called it military special. It was bourbon that I could buy for $1.10 a bottle. a fifth. And so I drank quite regularly with all my mates. But I liked the Army. The Army was getting to be a place that I felt comfortable. And I met some cool people. I met some guys who I really admired because of their military experience, their military prowess, their bearing, their intelligence. And I said, I'm going to try to be that kind of cool. So I buckled down, and I was a pretty good soldier. Shined my boots, pressed my uniforms, did all of the things that was expected of me, and became pretty good at my technical specialty. Trivia, I was a medic. So I did that for about 8 years. I had elected to go overseas, and I spent 7 years overseas in Asia, and really loved it over there. And was rapidly rising in rank, more so than I should have. And that was cool. And the nice thing about wearing stripes is, A, you're in charge of stuff, and you're in charge of people, and people do what you tell them to do. And I liked that. I liked having people do what I told them to do. And I liked people coming down and patting me on the back and telling me, hey, those guys that you told to do that job did a really good job. Thank you. And I got all the glory. Well, the Army had this program, has this program still, where they would take a dumb kid from Newport News and send him to flight school with just a high school diploma. All the other services require their pilots to have a degree. So they bundled me off to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and turned me into a helicopter pilot. Now, I got to tell you, even today, I think that's the coolest job in the world. Haven't done it in years, but that's a cool job. And I wasn't just a regular helicopter pilot. I was an attack helicopter pilot. I flew Cobras first and then Apaches, if you know what those are. And that is the coolest of the cool. You wore baggy green skin, big watch, handlebar mustache, aviator glasses, and a Stetson. I mean, is that cool? And then, that's about as cool as it comes. My opening line with the ladies at the bar was, hi, I'm Jack. I'm a Cobra pilot. I drive a BMW and I fly Cobras. How do you like me so far? And you know, that worked a lot. So along with that, in that milieu of attack helicopter pilots, was a culture of this. We were always pouring beer down our throats, slamming drinks. When we'd fly cross country, the old experienced guys knew the hotels to stay in that had maybe a free bar set up. and drinking became, that was something we did. You'd go into work, you pre-flight the helicopter, you'd go fly, you'd come down and go to the club. Wash, rinse, repeat. And we did that every day. And on off-duty time, I happened to notice, and I didn't notice then, but I thought it was normal. When we all got together, we drank. We drank quite a bit. But that was okay. I was cool. And I didn't really understand the path I was heading down. I did well. I did very well in that. Accelerated promotions, great assignments, got to go to amazing places, do amazing things, meet amazing people. And I never had a problem. I never had a problem. There was a day or two where I told the boss, I'm feeling a little under the weather. I probably shouldn't fly today. And in retrospect, I think my boss knew that I probably shouldn't fly. We had a regulation that said 12 hours bottle to throttle. And I was meticulous about that. I would take my last drink exactly 12 hours before I was supposed to take off. So I met the letter of the law. Was I always clear-headed? Nah. There were times that I had to use a barf bag. I did fly drunk once, but that's another story. So I had a little medical issue that compelled me to quit flying for a while. And in doing so, the Army had to find a place for me. And they put me in a staff job, made me fly a desk. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I went in there, and well, to tell you how it is, I signed into the job on a Thursday, and the following Tuesday, I was briefing a 4-star general in the Pentagon. And I was brought into a whole new world of things about the military that I did not know. I did that for 2 years. By the time I quit doing that job, I had developed a whole new skill set. Learned all sorts of things, met all sorts of people, understood more things about how the military works than you could shake a stick at, and was cool. When the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army calls you by your first name, that's cool. When he sees you in the halls of the Pentagon, says, "Hey Jack, how you doing?" "Doing great." He let me call him by his first name, sir. Yeah. But that was cool. The other neat thing about that job, I traveled all the time, and I loved to travel. And I was traveling on somebody else's dime. I was flying once or twice a week somewhere in the United States. And when you fly that much, where do you end up? You get upgraded to the business class, where you're sitting there slamming Delta's drinks for free. And I learned the rhythm of which hotels had happy hour or discount price bars. And that was where I would sign into. I'd check into those hotels. And then the other trick I had was to, gee, I don't want to miss my flight. I probably ought to get to the airport 3 hours early. Well, they have bars in airports. Yep. How great to be able to go there and sit there and have a drink and lie to yourself. I'd always order Bloody Marys. What I really wanted was a Crown and Coke because I felt like shit. But Bloody Mary, that's cool, right? That's what a cool guy drinks at the airport bar. After 28 years, the Army decided, I heard these grumblings that I was going off to do an unaccompanied tour without family in Korea. Well, I had been to Korea in the 70s. And my impression was that it was a dump and I didn't want to go back. I really don't know what it's like today. A lot of people say they love it, but I didn't want to go. And the writing was on the wall, and I elected to retire from the Army. Put in my paperwork, said I want to retire in a year, and a couple of months later, a guy called and said, "I'd like you to come to work for me." I went, "Wow. When would you like me to start?" And he said, "How soon can you start?" And I called the guys that had my retirement paper and I said, "Can we accelerate that? Can I be out in like a month or two?" And they went, yeah, good. Out I went. No more cool flight suit, no more Stetson. I kept the glasses, the big watch. But now I'm wearing Brooks Brothers. This is cool. And I'm still flying on someone's dime. And I'm still staying in nice hotels. And people are still calling me by my first name. And the job I went to was the most amazing job in the world. Up at Fort Eustis. If you can imagine, we got what, 25 people in here? If you can imagine 14 people managing a $5 billion pot of money, it was heaven. It was absolute heaven. And it was heaven for a couple of reasons. A, I got to travel and drink and party and do all of that. And where I traveled to was to see people who were providing us products and goods and services for the people I was working for. And they treated me like a king because I had the checkbook. And here I was. Not only was I cool in wearing the Brooks Brothers, but I had the checkbook, and people would do what I told them to do. And they would do it with a smile. That it was so friggin' great. I did travel with a coworker one time who chastised me. We took our rental car back to the airport, and I stopped in the airport bar, and he said, you know, we're still on the clock. Okay. Yeah, I see where you're coming from. Because we would bill our hours out until we got home. And so that was the only time anything that was ever said about my drinking. Now, in that interim, in that time period, I was all about the job. And I lost interest in hobbies and activities and things that I used to enjoy. I didn't know where they went. I really didn't care. I was having a great time. To go on vacation, my wife would have to nudge me. She said, let's go do this, let's go do that. Things that I used to enjoy. And all of a sudden, they didn't have the cachet that they used to have. Roll the clock forward a little bit. I was fortunate in that I was able to pay off a mortgage on my house very early. Came into some money. My wife said, why am I still working? I said, well, let me look at the books and see if you need to work. So I took a look at the books and told homegirl, quit, you don't need to work anymore. So my wife retired at the age of 50 and has been spending money ever since. Well, I pulled out those books and took a look at them myself and said, why am I still working? So I don't need to work. So I told the people I was working for, I'm thinking about not working. And they said, what will it take to keep you around? I just said, money won't do it. I've got all I can spend. I followed up a project that I was on, took another 4 or 5 months, and then I punched out. And when I hung up the Brooks Brothers, and when I found out I was going to have to pay for my own airplane tickets, and that I was going to have to pay for my own hotel rooms, and I looked at who I was, and I was an unemployed guy. I was not cool anymore. My military life had been in the past. My life in the government business world didn't exist anymore. I was an unemployed guy sitting on his front porch in Portsmouth, Virginia, with nothing going on for him. But it had a good side. It had a good side. I can drink when I want. That's how I thought was a good side. So, and I'm smart. Uber had been invented. So I Ubered to my bar every day, every afternoon, and I sat there, and I watched all the sad people at the bar telling the stories of what they could have been, and more tragically, regretting that they had lost who they had been. And I'd take a drink and go, yep, gotcha, understand. Well, that trip to the bar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon became trip to the bar at 11:30 in the morning. And then I would get home sometime whenever the Uber brought me home, have a couple of more, pass out. And then this habit of getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and substituting box wine for orange juice took over. So I'd have, and homegirl would come down and say, are you drinking wine at 6 o'clock in the morning? Yeah, why not? Got nothing better to do today. You know, why not? That was a spiral that I didn't know I was on. Roll the clock forward. Sitting in my bar, it was the first time I ever said this to myself. And this guy came in, stone drunk. I'm surprised if he's still alive today. And he said, the judge is sending me to AA because of my umpteenth DUI. And he said, I don't think I should have to go to AA. Jack, do you think I'm an alcoholic? Well, you know, I didn't know a whole lot about alcoholism. But I told him, yeah, I think you are. And he said, what makes you say, how can you say that? And I said, because I'm one too. And the first time in my life I said that, I'm an alcoholic. Did I do anything about it? Nah. I was okay being an alcoholic. I still had a house, still had Uber, still had money in my pocket. Wasn't living underneath the overpass. I was still considered myself a functional alcoholic. I was dysfunctional as hell. I was dysfunctional with all my relatives, friends, family. It was a bad place to be. But fortunately, I don't remember a whole lot of it. Roll forward to about 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago. I had a neurological emergency and ended up in Portsmouth Navy Medical Center with this neurological emergency. And if you remember 4.5 years ago, we had this kick-ass variety of flu going around. Well, I don't know if I took it into the hospital with me, but I sure had it when I got there. So you take a neurological issue, a dose of flu, and throw the DTs on top of that. I mean, I see you because I was having some heart issues as well. And I was a sick puppy. I was a real sick puppy. My primary care physician came by and she said, you know, I really, really wish you would do something about those two drinks a day you're having. Because, you know what you tell your doctor? I'd always told her that. Yeah, I smoke half a pack and two drinks a day. And she said, because that's kind of one of the reasons you're in here. I said, I'll give it some consideration. Well, this Navy captain, I think he may have been the chief of the surgery department, not my physician, had absolutely nothing to do with my medical case, came and sat down by my bed and pulled up a chair and said, I'm Captain so-and-so, Captain Doctor so-and-so, and I want to talk to you for a few minutes. I said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And he says, I have a brother that you remind me of. I've looked at your medical charts, I've looked at your medical history, I've looked at all your labs from all of this, and you're drunk. My brother's a drunk. And my brother won't listen to me, and he's going to die drunk. He said, I'm watching my brother die. And he said, I would seriously ask that you consider doing something to turn you into something other than a drunk. So my primary care physician came back and said, hey, you talked to so-and-so, what is your plan? And I had, he had left me alone for hours, and I looked around, you know, you're looking at tubes, and oh, by the way, if you're the drunk in the hospital, you don't get treated as well as maybe the baseball player, you know? Being the drunk in the hospital ain't cool. So I said, well, what are my options? She said, I'll send some psychiatrist or some social worker or somebody up to talk to you. Left me with a bunch of stuff. And I read it. Discharged me from the hospital, but I wasn't allowed to leave the home because I was still had some neurological issues. And I told my wife, who had cleaned out all the booze in the house, and I didn't really want any. I'd had 13 days of drying out in the hospital. I was over the DTs. I didn't have a craving for a drink. Plus, I still felt like crap. I said, I'm going to give this AA stuff a try. I'm going to give it a try. Because I think I need something. And this may be the key. So after 30 days of not drinking, I went down the street close to my home to Maryview. And I'm looking for the conference room on the second floor. And I get out of the elevator on the second floor, and I don't see any signs that say conference room. And I said, hey, I'm lucky. I couldn't find it. Honey, I tried. I couldn't find it. And this guy named David Moore came by and said, you looking for the AA meeting? Damn. Yeah, I am. Yeah, I am. Well, come with me, come with me. And I walked into this room, there's 40 people in there. And like so many of you have probably said yourself at your first AA meeting, what the hell are these people so happy about? Yeah. What is this? They had some stuff up on the wall. They had some of this stuff up there. There's 12 of these and 12 of those. I looked at that and said, I don't know what that's all about. And I listened to them. Don't remember anything anybody said. Got up to go, and I'm ready to head out because I really wanted a cigarette. And this woman grabs my hand. I wonder how she grabbed my hand. We all stood in a little circle and said the Lord's Prayer. Got home. Well, I said, how was it? I said, it was pretty weird. Pretty friggin' weird. I mean, those people are not alcoholics. You know, they're all clean. Happy, they're smiling, they're not stumbling into stuff. She said, you going back? I said, you know, I believe I am. Just see how weird they get. Well, after I started to understand what the routine was, we're going to say this, we're going to say this, we're going to say this, we're going to pass this basket around, you're going to give us a buck, and drink all the coffee you want, and we're going to say the Lord's Prayer. And in between, you're going to hear people. And I started hearing people say things, and I went, I did that. I felt like that one time. And so I kept coming back. And someone said, at every meeting, you hear it at every meeting, get a big book. I said, what's this big book thing? They said, here, you can have it. Get a sponsor. Well, it's a sponsor. That's a guy that'll do this for you. He'll walk you through that big book. Find a home group. Had no idea what that was. So there was this guy talking in there, and I'd been going to meetings for about a month. And I walked up and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a sponsor. Would you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to do this?" I said, "Yeah, I am." Bada bing, bada swing, I had a sponsor, and the work began. I wish he was here tonight. He couldn't make it, because I like to call him, I like to say I picked him because he was a prick, because that's the kind of person I need to guide me through life. You know, I can't, don't wipe my nose and powder my butt. That isn't going to work. You're going to have to be a jerk. So he had me do this and this and this and this, and write all this stuff down. And this is where I'm coming to my theme, my big point of the evening, my point of the evening. You may not think much of it. I'm doing all these little things. I had a resentment against this person, and I didn't have any part to play in it. And it was because of my ego. I thought I'd done a pretty good job of taking an inventory. And he said, "What were you afraid of?" "What the hell do you mean, what was I afraid of? I haven't been afraid of nothing lately." He said, "Okay, next." I resented this person, and I still didn't have anything to do with it. And it was because of my pride. "What were you afraid of?" This went on and on and on. And he said, "We're going to sit here, and you're going to think about some of those things, about what you were afraid of." I said, "Can you help me along?" "Yeah." And he did. He said, "What were you afraid of here? What was going to happen if this didn't work out in your favor?" And this huge light went on. I had figured out, I've since figured out why I started drinking. I now know why I continued drinking, why I used alcohol as the solution for all the issues in my life. I call them issues because I rarely had problems. But all of the things that weren't going the way I wanted them to do, I had learned as a teenager, trying to be cool, that those feelings could be erased with alcohol. And then it hit me, that great big light bulb, that I had been afraid since I was a young teenager. Mentions in the good book, big book, right over there. I was afraid of not having the things I wanted. I had a successful career, but there were some things that I didn't get. You know, I never wanted a Ferrari, but I was afraid of not getting the things I wanted. Whether it was respect, love, people listening to me, doing what I wanted them to do. And I was afraid of losing the things I had. Losing the things I had and losing the things I wanted is what I seriously, thoroughly believe to this day drove me across the precipice of alcoholism. I had seen that the stuff works, and I used it for 55 years or better. And it quit working. Today, when I encounter a situation that I don't know how to handle. They're not all solved intuitively anymore. I still have to think about some of them, especially in interpersonal relationships. I have to ask myself, what are you afraid of? And normally I will get an answer, it's generally one I don't like, and then that takes some more work. So in my journey in AA, I've learned a couple of things. I learned why I used alcohol, why I started using alcohol, to be cool. And I continued to use it to stay cool, maybe even get cooler. And then I learned that when I was misusing it, it was because of two reasons. I was afraid of losing what I had, afraid of losing what I wanted. So here I am. And that's all I got. Subject to your questions, that's all I got. Oh, wait a minute. I got two more minutes to talk about myself.
Thank you for coming out tonight and sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Appreciate it. Seventh tradition. Yeah. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers rent and supplies for the group. The rest is distributed to our AA service entities. Are there any AA-related announcements? Steve.
My name is Steve Roach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
Hello, Steve.
We're grateful to the Charity Message Group from Orphans for providing our speakers this month. And next week, the speaker will be our very own Margaret L.
All right. Yes. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
My name is Greg and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Greg.
My home group, the Craddock Oasis Group, meets at the Scout Cabin, 3605 Winchester Drive in Portsmouth. We have been having a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday meeting at noon. They've now added Thursday. So now it's Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at noon. Come out and support it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
What happened Tuesday?
There's not enough Tuesday yet. working on it. One day at a time.
Are there any other announcements? All right, I've asked a volunteer to present the chips.
All right, I'm James Alcoholic.
Hey.
Here at the Interaction Group, just like other groups, we have a chip system. The first one is the white chip. If you heard something in here tonight that you like and you want to start a new way of life, come up and get a white chip. The only one you can get that you've been drinking your fingers. Pick it out of there. Get a pair of tongs. Yeah. A little rough around the edges. And I know I was rough around the edges when I came. So anybody want a white chip? All right, the rest of these you got to work for. Does anybody have 90 days? And that includes nights, weekends, holidays, Super Bowls, or anything else included in that. 90 days. All right, the next one is 6 months, half a year. Anybody got 6 months? All right, the next one is 9 months. Anybody got 9 months? All right, this one here. Does anybody have